Tuesday night edition of the pod as the Boston Celtics roar back in the second half to take it 107-94 over the Cavaliers. And LeBron James came out firing, 42 points, 12 assists, did have 6 turnovers though. Cleveland's defense was actually pretty decent throughout most of the first half. And then in the second half, the Cavaliers just couldn't score. They only put up 39 points, 94 points for Cleveland. And that Cavaliers offense that so struggled in the first round and so destroyed Toronto in the second round has regressed once again. And Boston, of course, has had a very big part in causing that.
For sure. I thought a place to start with this game would be to talk about LeBron's night. And so you mentioned in the beginning that he was absolutely on fire. He had 21 points in the first quarter on 8 of 13 shooting, 4 of 7 from 3, and 5 of 9 on jump shots. So that includes his mid-ranger. In the rest of the game, 8 of 16 and 3 of 9 on those jump shots. And we talked about this a little bit on the Twitter NBA show because we were doing this game live, that it's possible, though there are other factors, including the collision with Jason Tatum that we'll definitely talk about in some depth later on, that LeBron being so successful with the jumper early ended up not necessarily working out super well for them because he felt more comfortable settling for that as opposed to getting all the way to the basket.
Yeah, and again, LeBron's shot chart, he got to the rim a couple times late when the outcome was essentially decided and they were kind of in no threes defense. But taking a look at his shot chart here, that's 16 of 29 from the field, 11 three-point attempts. He ended up 7 of 8 at the rim. But again, some of those were late. And he really was not getting into the paint, forcing help, setting up others. And then when he did try to set up others, anyone else except for Kevin Love and Kyle Korver just couldn't do anything in this game for Cleveland. Love was 2 of 6 from 3. Korver was 2 out of 5. And George Hill only got up 4 shots in 33 minutes. He was 0 for 2 from 3. J.R. Smith was 0 for 7 from the field, 0 of 4 from 3, although he was forced into some tough beat-the-clock shots late in possessions. So it really was just LeBron and Love, those two guys.
Did you mention Jeff Green?
Who was 2 for 5? Yeah.
And had 5 turnovers. I think those 5 turnovers were significant as well.
Especially in the fourth quarter when it was really getting away from him. And he tried to attack a couple of times. It just like threw it right to Jaylen Brown for one fast break that ended up actually being LeBron volleyballing Terry Rozier's shot into the stands. But yeah, it really just Cleveland looked awful in the second half. And once again, for the Celtics, they just don't have weak links out there for LeBron to attack. And then, although they do make mistakes on occasion, I thought that the Cleveland strategy early, the way that they ran their offense, looked awesome. And they just didn't have the energy to sustain that level of discipline play on either end throughout the entire game. Early in the game, they were abusing Boston switching. They were screening to contact, going backdoor. Love got a nice backdoor when LeBron was posting up. They got JR going to the rim one time off of some screening action, and they actually, you know, they were cutting hard. They were really lighting up Boston, and as so often has been the case in these playoffs, Boston just keeps competing and keeps bringing the energy, and they have all these athletes and all these bodies, even with Gordon Hayward and Kyrie Irving unavailable, and Daniel Tice for that matter as well, and they just wore down the Cavaliers, it seemed like.
Yeah, I was impressed with them on both ends of the floor, and the idea of kind of foundational competency that you talked about defensively and not having weak links, I think that also applies to their offense. And Cleveland has been exploited at times by the simple fact that, you know, other than Baines, and he's playing less than 20 minutes per game, I think it was 17 in this one, almost every single player that takes the floor for Boston is comfortable with the ball in their hands, can do a couple of dribbles and attack, and almost all of them have good first steps as well. So they can create opportunities where I didn't necessarily expect them to, even in the half court. I mean, Cleveland's transition defense being awful is not remotely a surprise, and I thought Jaylen Brown in particular did a great job attacking that. But Boston was creating more separation and doing a little bit more in the half court than I anticipated.
Yeah, and what really, where it stood out, I thought, was just they had so much more effort than Cleveland in the second half. Some of those offensive rebounds where Jaylen Brown missed a layup, gets it right back. LeBron never even moves to the defensive rebound. They got two offensive rebounds, and finally Marcus Smart got a tip. Again, LeBron never even moved to go get the defensive rebound. When Rozier got hot with 14 points in the third quarter, a lot of those were just pretty severe breakdowns. And Boston, you never see a guy, oh, we made a mistake, I'm just going to stand there. Even when they make a mistake, they try to hustle their way out of it, and half the time they're able to do it, even if the communication initially isn't there. So lots more on this game coming up here. But first, this from our new sponsor, Puppy Spot. Welcoming a puppy into your home is one of the most rewarding things that you'll ever do, but it's really difficult to be sure that they come from a responsible breeder, and that's where PuppySpot.com comes in. It's a trusted service that connects the nation's top breeders to caring, responsible individuals and families. Puppy Spot has really high standards. Only 10% of breeders that apply to be part of Puppy Spot are approved. They usually have about 50 plus different breeds available at any one time, over 100 plus puppies available to go home. Their puppy concierges are devoted to helping you find the right breed, from golden retrievers to Yorkies to Labradoodles. And their industry-leading health guarantee means that your puppy is given a nose-to-tail health exam from a licensed veterinarian and up-to-date vaccinations before coming home to you. And they actually have a 10-year health guarantee as far as any health issues that should have been caught before the puppy was delivered to you. And compared to, say, getting your puppy at a pet store, Puppy Spot has a commitment to the humane treatment of all dogs. Thanks to their travel program, your puppy will arrive in your home the same day it leaves its breeder. And until it arrives in your home, it spends its entire life with its breeder and parent. So the way to get started with them and fetch your new best friend at puppyspot.com/capspace. That's the URL for this one. That's /capspace. Easy to remember because we talk about it all the time here on the program. Puppyspot.com/capspace. For a limited time, you can get access to the Puppy Spot VIP program, which has discounts on everything you need for your new puppy, from food to walking services. Once again, that's puppyspot.com/capspace for this special offer. Puppyspot.com/capspace. So what else stuck out to you in this one, Danny?
Well, I think we should talk about the collision that we thought would have a bigger impact on the game, though we'll have to see how it affects LeBron James moving forward. It was late in the first half. LeBron was along the baseline, and he got run into by Jason Tatum. And no ill intent or anything like that. Jason Tatum was just trying to make a play defensively. And Tatum's shoulder made strong contact with the side of LeBron's head, and there was... I mean, we had a kind of a poll over our broadcast on the Twitter NBA show because it looked bad. LeBron left the floor. We were very concerned about a concussion. It ended up being determined that he had a neck strain rather than a concussion. So I don't know how that affected him, but it certainly changed the game, even though the Cavs did well in his absence.
Yeah, at least they did in the first half. They're about even without him in there, and plus 10 with him in the game in the first half. In the second half, not so much. They were down 7 to start the fourth, and then with LeBron out of the game, they had a couple of just miserable offensive possessions and ended up getting down by double digits, and that was pretty much about the game at that point. They never really got back into contact after that, did the Cavs. But I think LeBron, you know, I can't tell based on a collision whether someone has suffered a concussion or not. They took him in the back, they tested him, they found that he did not have a concussion, but certainly he looked to be having some difficulty right after the collision. And I don't know that he played just so much worse than he was playing in the second quarter. He already, you know, he had that 21 in the first quarter, but then hadn't been quite as aggressive. We noted he settled more for jumpers, but I think he kind of got into that rhythm even late in the first quarter. So I can't say whether it had a huge difference. I mean, certainly the score of the game, both before and after, is an indication, and maybe you can say too that he just wasn't as into it defensively, and that was a big part of the problem. Certainly he had a number of breakdowns, a number of low effort plays in the second half, and I think, you know, we go back to again with LeBron the idea that he's constantly saving energy, and he has to save energy because there's no one else who can create anything on this team other than him. And maybe that's giving Kevin Love a little bit of short shrift, but certainly he's the only one with any ability to attack the basket off the dribble. And so he's constantly looking for times to save energy. And even when, you know, he's standing right there for a defensive rebound, there's always a danger when your default as a player is, I'm either not going to do something or I'm going to evaluate in every situation whether to give effort. And the Boston Celtics don't do that. They see the ball and they go for it every single time. When you're trying to decide whether you're going to react before you react every time instead of just doing it, you're always going to be slower reacting. And so LeBron can have possessions where he'll decide to be engaged, and he'll be engaged throughout that possession. But over the course of the game, his default is trying to find rest anywhere he can. And that's where I think a lot of the lack of support that he has here shows up.
And that functions in direct contrast to Marcus Smart, who on a couple of plays late in this game actually was aggressive and got a ball that LeBron maybe could have. There was that huge offensive rebound where LeBron just kind of evaluated and he thought they were going to have it, and Smart just flew in, got it, and that helped kind of salt away the game. And Marcus Smart is a challenging player sometimes to evaluate and discuss because he provides so much energy and intangible value. But I thought one of the most important parts of his game was getting steals when the Cavaliers were kind of getting going in transition. So he had two on outlet kick ahead passes, and then he had one, I believe was in the fourth quarter, where he just went after the ball before the hit ahead pass. They were just moving the ball up the court, and those created really good looks for the Celtics.
Yeah, that was the case as well. They tried the Cavaliers to start Tristan Thompson, and I didn't think he played poorly. Four offensive rebounds, 8 points. He was negative five, although it seems clear to me that Thompson just is not the guy that he was as a switch defender, whether he's just not in the same type of shape or it's that early season calf injury or whatever it is. He was getting cooked pretty badly on switches in this game, and by guys who aren't necessarily even the best ISO players in the league either. You know, I mean, I think he even got beat by Smart one time. Tatum, who is a rookie, a solid ISO player, but, you know, I mean, Tristan Thompson has had a great record guarding like really good ISO players on the other team. And so he's not quite the same defensively in the switching, and just Cleveland just doesn't really seem to have a plan. They have no defensive identity, and this isn't news. You know, LeBron is not that player protecting the rim, especially now that he can't take possessions off and let Kyrie Irving go to work on offense. Love is limited. George Hill is nowhere close to the guy that he was even a couple of years ago when his last year in Indiana when he shut down Kyle Lowry. J.R. Smith had myriad miscommunications in this game. They really were targeting him with any kind of an action designed to force communication and switch. I think there was like three possessions in a row where JR and Tristan Thompson both just like were looking at each other with their palms up. I mean, the number of times that JR would just like almost stalk towards the bench with his palms up after some sort of a miscommunication, it really stuck out to me. They also brought in Larry Nance, who I thought was okay. But again, you know, these guys, it's really interesting to me that these guys just cannot get any field goal attempts, right? Like Larry Nance, he was 0-for-1. He missed an alley-oop on a pass that was a little bit behind him. And Hill, 33 minutes and four shots. It's I don't know whether it's because that they are able to help on LeBron and make him pass it and then close these guys down, or whether just their system does not look that great. But clearly the Celtics have them completely out of rhythm.
And one that I would add into that, Tristan Thompson had six shot attempts, but he had four offensive rebounds. Oh, yeah. So if you think that each one of those gets you pretty dang close to a shot attempt, to only end up with six is pretty striking. And the Thompson, one of his biggest weaknesses as a offensive player is that he is not great at attacking a mismatch on a post-up. You and I have spent a lot of time on Dunked On this year discussing the strengths of that approach. And Thompson just doesn't have the versatility. So he thinks he has these mismatches. And it was that one time where LeBron basically like looked him off of a post-up. He's like, you don't have an advantage here.
Yeah, that was really weird seeing him try to post up a couple of times. For the Celtics, Al Horford had another awesome game. 15 points. His jumper actually was off in this one, but still had 10 rebounds. The Celtics actually had more offensive rebounds than the Cavs. Thompson, who has long tormented Horford, and they still started Horford at center, by the way, too, even with them starting Thompson. Maybe it was an invitation to start Baines that they just did not take, which I think was a smart move from Stevens. But Horford did well enough on the defensive glass. And the other thing, too, is they've got guys now with so much more size. I mean, this is, if you compare this year's team to last year's team, between Jaylen Brown playing more minutes, Tatum, Rozier, you know, think of he had five defensive rebounds in this game. Marcus Morris, I mean, they're pretty either other than center, maybe with Horford, they've got good size and good length at every position. Ojale is another strong guy. Marcus Smart, when he's not playing at the three, which he had to play a lot last year, you know, he's a guy with plus strength and length for his position. So they're able to control the defensive glass much better and maybe get some of those hustle offensive rebounds of their own. And then Horford, I thought, even though Love had a decent game in this one, they really avoided fouling him. No Cavalier took more than two free throws aside from LeBron. So keeping Love off the foul line is huge. I don't think Love had a single basket in the post. Do you remember any?
No, I think it was more he had a couple dunks. He had that athletic layup where that was a really impressive play where he kind of got the ball over his head as he was going past. But no, I don't remember any true post-ups.
Yeah, and Horford did a really nice job. I mean, there was one play or one series of plays early in the third quarter when Love pick and popped three times in a row and Horford just shut him down all three times. And it was just an amazing job by Al Horford closing out on Love. I mean, there's just so few guys. And Boston, they really changed up their looks quite a bit. A lot of it depended, I think, on whether Smart was in the game, because they put him onto Kyle Korver and had him trail around screens. And Korver had a little bit of success, but overall, I thought Smart did pretty well there. When Cleveland was beating their switches early, they went with a little more conventional style. With Baines in the game, they went with a little more conventional style. But they really seemed to be changing up the looks pretty regularly. I found it difficult as we were calling the game to really get a rhythm for exactly what the rules were. And so I think that's something that really giving LeBron James different looks is really important. And that's probably part of why they're able to have some of this success.
I was also impressed that Boston was able to score reliably without Jason Tatum really getting into much of a rhythm in the game. He did score a couple times on Tristan Thompson, yeah, but I thought generally
those
Tristan
were big,
did a pretty
actually.
Good job,
I mean,
defensively.
They were looking like they were. Might be getting close to blown out in that second quarter, and he hit some. I mean, he had this one jumper on the left wing. One was a step back three in the corner on Thompson. The other one was his feet were. It was like a Klay Thompson shot when he's super hot. His feet like weren't even together. It's got his feet wider than his shoulder. It's so hard to jump from that position. He drained a jumper off of that too.
Yeah, so they were able to go through it and get success. I mean, Jaylen Brown had 14 in the first quarter. I thought that was really important as Boston ended up only scoring 23. So he had more than half of their points at that point in that juncture. And Boston, I think they got, this was a little bit closer to what I thought the games in the Garden might be like, where, you know, Boston was making they made their threes. Both teams were 10 of 31 from three, which is interesting.
Yeah, but, and they both, and, actually, I mean, Cleveland, they were 7 of 14 in the first half. So they're only 3 out of 17 in the second. And Boston was shooting it pretty well as well. I think at one point they were 9 out of 23, mm-hmm. and then they went 1 for their last 8. So both teams were a little bit off towards the end.
Yeah, and that can happen in the playoffs, though I don't think it was necessarily great defense on most of those. There were certainly some. But so what I was getting at is that I wondered after game one what regression to the mean would look like in this series. And so Boston making fewer shots, Cleveland making a few more, and the answer was a close game for the most part until Boston took control late. And Cleveland, with more consistency defensively, better communication, better execution probably more than anything else, they could have won this game. But Boston unquestionably, unequivocally in the win. And so now we get into this challenging place in the series for Cleveland where, yes, they absolutely can win. They have to win all of their home games for sure and then take one of the two in Boston. But they do have to come out victorious in 4 out of 5 of the remaining contests.
And I believe they can do that to at least win both games in Cleveland. I mean, I think, obviously, I picked Cleveland in the series. Boston, though, has been unbelievable at home in these playoffs. They are now 9-0 at home in these playoffs and 1-4 on the road. But they have, of course, the home court advantage. I mean, I don't think I would favor them in either of these two games in Cleveland. Well, I might in game four if Cleveland loses game three and it's 3-0, you know, I could see LeBron really checking out in game four. And they've got a 3-day rest period to kind of think about everything that's gone wrong here. But I think the most likely outcome is that we're going to be headed back to Boston 2-2. Like this series, especially with this massive home road disparity that we've seen from Boston, I think that we could very easily be back 2-2. And then, you know, usually that would be a massive advantage for the home team. But certainly to say that LeBron and this Cavaliers team can't win games in this series, I think, you know, I wouldn't take that away from this game. But the Cavaliers have got to find a way to score. And, you know, maybe that's more of Love at center again. Kyle Korver only played 21 minutes in this game. I think that he was removed from the starting lineup for Thompson. I think Lou reached somewhat the opposite conclusion that I did, that they needed to be better defensively in this game. And, you know, Korver is probably their third best offensive player, so to only play him 21 minutes, especially as poorly as JR was playing. And yeah, I get that Korver isn't very good one-on-one, but like with all the mistakes JR was making, I'd probably rather just have Korver out there at this point than JR, who has just had a horrendous series so far. And it's just amazing how he runs so incredibly hot and cold in some of these games and series. But I loved they finally got to that screening action out of the corner that we've been talking about all playoffs with Rozier's man and screening for Kevin Love. And they got great stuff out of that a couple of possessions and then just weren't really able to get back to it for whatever reason. So I still want to see more of that. Like, I haven't seen a team stop that action yet with the smallest guy screening Love from the corner into the post and then popping out for a three. So I want to see some more of that. For sure. What do you think? Would you stick with Thompson in the starting lineup, or would you go back to Kevin Love at center?
I think I'd go back to Love. It was interesting that Stevens kept Baines out of the starting lineup, but brought him back in pretty quickly for Tatum, especially because Tatum didn't really start either half with much of a rhythm. But I think Cleveland's offense is, I mean, their defense sucked in this game anyway. So right. They were, I guess, a little bit better in that first quarter. So he's not bringing the benefit there. And while Thompson got four offensive rebounds and the Celtics have to account for him in that part of the floor, just having the spacing that Korver provides gives them a greater advantage overall. But it is a tough call. And Lou is obviously working with more information than we have. But yeah, I would start Korver.
I think so too, especially try to jump onto them offensively early at home, get the crowd into it. And frankly, Cleveland's best defense in this series is making the Celtics take the ball out of the net, because anytime they get in transition, I mean, even like the mildest transition opportunity, when you consider just the lack of communication, the jogging back, certainly anytime LeBron misses a shot, it's basically like an automatic bucket going the other way, unless he's shooting a three from the top of the key, because they just cannot get matched up. JR, Love, LeBron, I mean, LeBron will get a chase down every once in a while, but these guys are all, in terms of their communication, just totally inadequate. They're not going to get back to the paint and then sprint out to shooters. It's just not part of their DNA. So, I mean, I think the only way that they can get better defensively is just make the ball go in the basket more and make this an offensive series. And considering that Thompson played 30 minutes, you know, they did not get those supercharged spacing lineups early in this one. But still, I mean, it's really been impressive. This is the first team other than, I mean, I guess the Pacers did it too in the first round. So, I mean, maybe what all this comes down to, Danny, is just the Toronto Raptors really just sucked in that series. Maybe that's what this is all about.
Well, and it could even be, I mean, the Raptors had some pretty decent stretches in that series, especially in first halves. They just lost it at moments of that series and then lost the thread. One other point I want to bring up quickly, before in our series preview for this, I talked about Boston's half-court offense. Boston scored 105, had a 105 offensive rating in the half court in this game. Cleveland had a 92.6 offensive rating in the half court. I did not see that coming. Full credit to the Celtics for being fabulous in this game on both ends in a way that I did not expect.
I also think that Cleveland has got to do, and their game plan discipline is just so bad. And they just, like, Marcus Smart had 9 assists and 9 field goal attempts in this game. They just are reacting to him so much. Like, you should be going under on every screen. I want to make Marcus Smart shoot 8 three-point attempts if he's going to play 31 minutes. I mean, he was running pick and roll a lot, getting to the rim. He had one really crazy finish around Kevin Love, but he was 3 out of 9, and he's plus 21. But I think, like, they got to just, I mean, I would just put LeBron on Marcus Smart and just have LeBron camp out in the paint, basically, and say, hey, Marcus, if you want to beat us, go ahead. And maybe, you know, Marcus had that one crazy game in game 3 last year, the one game that they won. And so maybe because of that game, they kind of overrate what he's able to do offensively. But when you can't find any other way of stopping him, I think just not guarding him has got to be the way to go.
Treat him like another defensive first wing from Oklahoma State.
Yeah, Tony Allen, right? That's and 28 minutes of Jeff Green is too much. But Lou is certainly, I think I would go with Jetty Osman more. He only played 2 minutes, but a guy to give them a little bit more energy, try to match the intensity of the Celtics Jeff Green having to make decisions did not go well. He was negative 17 in this game in 28 minutes. I think he's was able to play against Toronto because it's kind of a simple game against Toronto. But when he has to make decisions on defense, it's not going to work out as well. And offensively, the lineup that he put out there, Lou, without LeBron in the fourth was really bad. You know, that you were getting the combination of Nance and Green together again now, which is pretty miserable. So I think they just, Bill Simmons has made this point that they have what, maybe like 4.5 guys that you can count on. You know, JR is Jekyll and Hyde. Thompson, you know, I guess he's got to play a lot. Love, James Hill, who has not been good so far in this series. Korver, Rodney Hood was negative 7. He got taken out for good when he just rose up in the air with absolutely nowhere to go and threw it right to a Celtic in the fourth quarter as part of that pretty miserable run without James out there for a few minutes at the start of the fourth. But I think they got to just ride the guys who have produced a little bit more than they have already and see what they can end up doing it in game three. I do expect them to win game three. I also said I expect them to win game two. I also said I expect them to win game one. So I'm not ready to give up on Cleveland yet. This is two home games. Boston is a different team on the road. But, you know, this could be the last game, essentially, of the LeBron James era on Saturday night. And can't wait to see it. There's going to be a crap ton of drama in that one. Anything else you want to say on this one, or shall we move on to our next segment?
We can move on. I'm really excited for game three, though.
Well, if you have a growing small business, you should be really excited as well. We are small business owners here. We're happy to see that our small business is growing, but we're lucky enough that our finances are relatively simple. If you are a company that is outgrowing QuickBooks and you're dealing with shared spreadsheets, manual processes, legacy systems, that's costing you time and money, take a look at NetSuite by Oracle. That's the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform. With NetSuite, you can save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, HR, finance, and accounting instantly. You can even do it on your phone if you own a small business. You've maybe got the flexibility to get away, but you got to work remotely a lot. Being able to use NetSuite on your phone is a great advantage. And better yet, it's more affordable than you think. They are offering you valuable insights at NetSuite to help you overcome the obstacles that are holding you back for free. They have this free guide, Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth, which will teach you how to acquire new customers, increase profits, and finally get real visibility into your cash flow. The way to get started with that guide, Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth, at netsuite.com/capspace. That's netsuite.com/capspace. Easy to remember. We were talking about capspace all the time here on our off-season previews. That's netsuite.com/capspace to download their free Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth guide to get today. netsuite.com/capspace. Well, let's talk about the Los Angeles Clippers now. We have not really been thinking of them too much. They do have two picks. Oh, wait, you know what? Let's talk about the lottery first. What the hell am I thinking? I completely forgot about it.
I didn't want to interrupt you. Because we'll do both. But that's a little bit of a tease for where we're going after that. But yeah, the lottery.
Because the title of the show really doesn't. They have no idea what's coming.
My hope is that people just, they don't even look at the title. They're just downloading and clicking so fast. They're just like, hey, wherever Nate and Danny want to take us, we'll go. But yeah, the lottery ended up, the number one pick held. Phoenix had the worst record by virtue of Memphis winning with those surprising games. Marshawn Brooks should be a marked man in Memphis because Phoenix had the best lottery odds. They got the number one overall pick. Then Sacramento jumped all the way from 7 to number 2, and Atlanta went from 4 to 3. So then that meant because Sacramento jumped so high that four different teams went down below their projected spot with the lottery odds. Memphis dropped 2 spots to 4, Dallas dropped 2 spots to 5, Orlando dropped 1 to 6, and Chicago dropped 1 to 7.
And for Sacramento, this is now the second year in a row that they have bumped into the top three. But you'll recall, of course, that they had to swap with Philly last year because of the July 1st, 2015 trade, Vlade Divac's maiden voyage with cap management. But at least they got Rajon Rondo and Kostas Koufos with all that cap space. But I digress. So this should be a happy time for the Kings to have the number two overall pick. And certainly we haven't gotten into our scouting yet. I don't have an opinion yet as to who Phoenix should take, but they have just a lot of pressures pulling them with either DeAndre Ayton or Luka Doncic. Of course, their new coach, Igor Kokoschkov, coached Doncic to a Eurobasket title with Slovenia last summer. And of course, DeAndre Ayton played just down the road from them at Arizona. So they will have all the information that they need about these prospects and more. Just thinking about it right off the top of my head, though, Ayton, his issues are supposed to be with defensive intelligence and help defense. And that has not been the sort of player that the Suns have had a lot of success with recently, although certainly with Kokoschkov as the coach now, that could change. And they also, I think, are a team that desperately needs passing, and Doncic could provide that. But, I mean, this is the number one overall pick. You pick whoever you think is the best available, and, you know, regardless of fit, essentially, except in very extreme circumstances.
It's also worth noting that two of the three teams with top three picks have other picks in the first round. Phoenix, while they did not get Milwaukee's pick, they do get Miami's, which is 16. Atlanta has 19 and 30 in addition to number three. So they can try to plug multiple holes. Both those teams aren't going to be in the playoff mix in all likelihood, even if they absolutely nail those picks. So they'll be adding young talent, just trying to build the base as best they can. And the benefit of that for all three of the teams that moved up is there isn't really anybody that is precluding them from taking a player. So, like, let's say, you know, Sacramento, I'm guessing they're happy with what Bogdan Bogdanovic did this year, but his presence does not stop you from taking Luka Doncic if you feel he is the best player remaining on the board. Likewise, Willie Cauley-Stein with DeAndre Ayton, and with Atlanta, they will have a series of options. We don't know who's going one and two, but with Bagley and whoever else is on the board there, we'll talk about that once we have a feel for the prospects. And I think that is a safer place to be, because one of the biggest mistakes that GMs, especially a bad teams, make is taking a player who is inferior because they have somebody else in the mix, even though that player is not necessarily a centerpiece of their future.
Yeah, and perhaps they misjudge that the guy is, in fact, a centerpiece, but certainly both. I mean, maybe you could see Phoenix saying, hey, we have Josh Jackson, we don't need Doncic. Maybe you could see them doing that. I hope for their sake they don't. That's not the reason. Again, I don't have an opinion yet on who they should take there or not. I mean, certainly Memphis and Dallas, those guys, I don't know that the pick has fallen far enough now for Memphis that they would consider trading it. They do appear fairly delusional about like where they can be as far as getting back in the playoffs and continuing the Conley and Gasol era. But I don't see them trading the pick nonetheless, but maybe there's a slightly greater chance of that now. The ones who really could have provided some of the intrigue, Cleveland with that Brooklyn pick, that ends up being number 8 overall. New York didn't move up at all. They're at 9. And then Philly, they actually had in the one remotely interesting thing of that just soul-crushing lottery show with 9 billion commercials in it and 45 minutes of fluff before they even started the drawing. They did have someone from both Philly and Boston sitting together at the same table, because if that pick had moved up in the top three, it could have been either Philly or Boston. But it goes to Philly at number 10. That finally completes, ironically enough, a trade in which Michael Carter Williams, the 11th pick, was traded away. And Sam Hinkie, such a genius, ended up getting back the 10th pick for him years later, although I think most people would have thought that that pick would have ended up higher. And the Lakers only avoided turning it over because they were so bad the last 3 years that they're able to jump into the protection.
Well, and they had lottery luck, right? Too. I mean, that pick could have converted in both of the last previous 2 years, and it ended up being the second pick.
So not as much chaos as we could have hoped for. Certainly those who complain that the NBA is rigged have a little bit less of a leg to stand on here, with Phoenix, Sacramento, and Atlanta being the three. And but we have to bid adieu to the old lottery system that has been in place for quite some time now, I think since the late 90s. Do you want to under the old system here, what were some of like your favorite lottery results under this system?
I mean, the Derrick Rose pick is certainly in that conversation. Oh, yeah. I mean, them flying up and getting to go
1.8%
home to Chicago.
Chance. My buddy Doug Tonis said that if they ever won a championship with Derrick Rose, he was going to get a 1.8% tattooed onto his body somewhere. But of course, that never ended up happening. But yeah, that was a crazy one.
It hasn't happened yet. It's not over. He hasn't retired yet.
No, he could come back.
And so that's one. The single, on the short list of the single worst trades that have happened in this millennium, is the pick that ended up, you know, the Clippers dumping Baron Davis, and that was the Kyrie pick.
Yes, it
right?
was. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was they didn't put enough protection on it, even though the Clippers
actually
could have.
And then, as it turned out, the amnesty came in the next CBA, so they didn't even really need to do that.
Yeah. The Sterling era was real bad.
Nothing will ever top, though, the Jerry West sitting there knowing that Memphis would either get the number one pick and draft LeBron James or get the number two pick and not be able to draft anyone at all because the pick would go to the Pistons because it was top one protected way back from the Otis Thorpe trade. That was in 2003. I think that's one for the ages for sure.
Well, and for a plug, because I feel like I should make this, part of the reason the reforms kicked in was because of the crazy 1993 lottery when the odds were more balanced and the Magic and Warriors both jumped up significantly and then made a major trade with each other. That was how the Warriors got Chris Webber. And if you want to read more about that, I actually talked about that at length in my book because it affected the Warriors and got into all the Chris Webber elements of it. So you can check that out. 100 things Warriors fans should know and do before they die.
That is a good plug. And also, we wouldn't be complete without the Cavaliers getting the number one overall pick 3 times in 4 years and using one of those on Anthony Bennett, another one on Andrew Wiggins, which is looking like not one of the better number one overall picks either, but then using Wiggins to get Kevin Love and having that all be a part of LeBron James returning. And of course, they drafted Kyrie Irving as well.
Well, does LeBron not including Andrew Wiggins in his letter count as a lottery memory?
No, that was almost 2 months afterwards. Like, that was like July like 8th or something like that in 2014.
Yeah, and I'm sure Lakers fans would be frustrated that we didn't include them improbably keeping their pick 3 years in a row when it was, I think, top five protected once and then top three the other 2 years. And even though they had the fourth best odds, I believe, one of those 2 years, they still kept their pick.
All right, well, now that with that fascinating recounting of how a bunch of ping pong balls bounce, I was having a conversation with the executive the other day. We were talking about the lottery, and I made the observation to him that there are two things that make these amazingly smart, competent, powerful NBA executives just go completely nuts. One is the lottery odds, and the other one is refereeing it, and just that they just cannot be objective about this stuff. I guess they could be objective about the lottery odds, but it's so funny to think about all these crazy planning and all the man hours that go into running your team, and then just gonna be luck determine whether you're gonna get to draft the superstar or not. Still, but democracy is the worst government ever invented, except for all the others. That's kind of how I feel about the lottery at this point. Let's talk a little LA Clippers off season now. What does their cap situation look like? And I think we can talk about it with and without DeAndre Jordan. And I think there's three potential scenarios with him. One is he just opts into that $24 million. The second one is he opts out and resigns. And the other one is he opts out and they just move on from him, or he moves on from them.
Let's start with Jordan leaving. It would still be very hard for the Clippers to have usable cap space. Basically, what I mean by that is more than they would get if they just use their exceptions. So they would have to lose Jordan, Avery Bradley, a bunch of their other guys. And if they re-sign DeAndre Jordan at $20 million or more, they're going to be right around the luxury tax, depending on which of their other players they bring back. And maybe Ballmer's willing to pay it. This Clippers team missed the playoffs this year, though I'm sure he will attribute some of that to bad injury luck, as has happened in the past with the Clippers.
I don't think they will be willing to pay the tax because they would be in the repeater tax if they do.
That's a good point. That's a very good point.
The best way, Larry Kuhn studied this a while ago, the optimal way to pay the tax the most possible number of years while never getting in the repeater tax is basically you're in for 3 years, you're out for 2 years to reset the clock, and then you're in for three again. So they need to be another year totally out of the tax, and then they don't have to worry about repeater tax anymore.
Well, and that ties in with one of the other quick points I wanted to bring up, which is that just keeping this in the back of your mind with the Clippers is that depending on if they don't re-sign their main guys this year, they could have up to about $65 million in space in 2019, so next offseason. And that doesn't even include ways that they could expand it beyond that by, let's say, stretching or trading Danilo Gallinari. That is just basically in straight space, no other cap magic involved.
Yeah, and certainly Kawhi Leonard is an LA native, or I'm sorry, San Diego native, but Southern California native.
Riverside, it's between them.
Yeah, I guess he went to school in San Diego State, but
he did. Yeah, there is this weird discussion. I inadvertently ended up in this maelstrom with saying that Kawhi was an LA guy once.
Yeah, I forgot he's from Riverside. Yeah, that's closer to L.A. probably than it is. It's like straight east of L.A. But anyway, enough on SoCal geography. You would think that this is just going to kind of be a consolidation year for them. I think if they had talked about, they've had some extension talks with Jordan. I think the best for them would be if he just opts in. I don't know if that's the best for him. But other than a sign and trade, I just don't know where he's going to get anything where he can get a longer term deal, even if it's for less than that $24 million. I just don't think he's that good anymore. He's 30 now, or will be very short by the start of the season. So maybe he does opt in, but then, you know, he's only getting older as well. I mean, I think if there is an extension, they actually can still do an extension, by the way, up until he either declines that option. If he opts in, obviously they can do an extension as well. Also worth noting that Jordan, if they want to trade him, has a 15% trade bonus. So if he opts in, that'll be a part of things as well. I mean, if you were advising DeAndre Jordan, we talked about this a little bit in the centers or the big man podcast when we did the free agent rankings, but what would you advise him to do?
Jordan got hurt a little bit by the lottery results because from what I've heard about this draft, it looks more likely that Dallas is going to be able to draft a big man at their spot. And there are so few teams with a lot of cap space and even fewer teams that would be willing to do like a sign and trade with DeAndre Jordan because center is a position like, let's say, Orlando. Yes, DeAndre Jordan would be better than all of their centers. But are they going to give up assets or just even try to facilitate a trade to get DeAndre Jordan? No, I don't think so particularly. So I would be leaning pretty heavily towards opting in at this point unless my agent had the intel that I could get a contract worth 15 to 18 per season for three or more seasons. One thing to consider, I don't have this locked in, but I believe because of everything that happened, yeah, it did, that DeAndre Jordan has changed agents since that contract. And oftentimes, I remember this more with baseball, guys get out of their contracts because then their new agents can get a share of the contracts they negotiate.
Yeah, you'd think that there could be that element there as well. If they do move on from Jordan, they will need a center, but I think there are plenty of centers that they could get for around the full mid-level that would be totally adequate for them this season. I mean, I still see this being kind of just a similar year to last year where maybe with Gallinari back now, Tobias Harris, who this is the last year of his contract, he's someone that they might actually look to extend potentially, although he probably has designs on a little bit more than they can offer him. I don't know if he'll get it. Also, if Austin Rivers, $12.65 million player option, which I would project that he would opt into. That we are including that in our projections for them not really having any space. Wes Johnson, I think he's already opted in to his $6.1 million player option. That's already been reported. And then Teodosic, if you want to hear a little bit more about his decision to opt in or out, go back and listen to our point guards ranking podcast. I don't want to rehash that, but he has a player option for $6.3 million, which is only $2.1 million guaranteed if he opts in until July 15th, which is a later date. He also has a 15% trade bonus as well. So that'll be a fascinating decision for him. I would guess, though, that he would probably opt in. We don't need to talk much more about that. And then any other kind of housekeeping things for this team before we talk about who they might try to get in free agency?
Yeah, a couple of quick ones. So first of all, they have the 12 and 13 picks, no second round pick. They have non-guarantees on Avery Bradley. It's at about $5 million, and that doesn't guarantee until January 10th, which is a late date. The only thing you would see there would be if the injury is way more severe than we thought it was, but I would be beyond shocked to see him see that get declined. Also, CJ Williams has a minimum non-guarantee until the first day of the regular season, then it starts to guarantee a little bit. And Montrezl Harrell is the other free agent that we should talk about. Actually, there are two. Montrezl Harrell, restricted free agent, full bird, minimum cap hold, could absolutely, I would expect to see him back. I don't think there's going to be much of a market for Harrell, so they could get him at a backup center price, which is good because that's what he is. And Avery Bradley,
wow,
the lost man, and so many things that have happened.
I completely even forgot he was on this team. I mean, it's crazy to think of where his career has gone over the last year or so.
Yeah, so Bradley has a $13 million cap hold, full bird rights because they acquired him via trade. And I have no idea if the Clippers are interested in bringing him back long term. He, of course, has familiarity with Doc Rivers from Boston. Not that Doc is the GM anymore, obviously. But Bradley just doesn't necessarily fit in with a team that is retooling. The only way that I could see him coming back would actually be if the Clippers offered him a meaningful amount of money especially let's say if Jordan left, as a 1 year kind of make good contract and he doesn't really have any other offers, just on the idea of like, well, we might as well try. But I wouldn't support that as the Clippers. I would want to pivot a little bit harder, but he's going to run into some real challenges. I mean, with the groin surgery, just having a real lost season right before free agency, even though the other shooting guards in that mix, like KCP and Danny Green, didn't have great years either. The thinning market and just the lack of need for a two-only guy really hurts Bradley.
I thought KCP had a nice year, but maybe I'm in the minority there.
You often believe KCP had a nice year.
I mean, other than,
but I thought
other
he was fine.
The month that he was like under house arrest, he was pretty good. So now, whether that really had anything to do with it or not, who knows? It could have just been a random blip. But nonetheless, you know, the tax is still going to be an issue. Even if they let Jordan go, you know, they'll have maybe about $24 million or so to work with. And don't forget, they have these two draft picks as well. They've got 12th and 13th. That's taking up about $6 million worth of their space also. If they wanted to bring back Bradley, they've also got Patrick Beverley with a non-guarantee $5 million. His guarantee date isn't until the end of the league-wide cut-down date of January 10th. But between Beverley, Lou Williams, who remember they extended at $8 million per season, Rivers, Teodosic, if they bring him back, they still got Juwan Evans and Sendarius Thornwell, who are both guaranteed for next year. They've got CJ Williams. Tyrone Wallace is going to go into two-way restricted free agency, and his qualifying offer is only a two-way contract. But you have to imagine that someone would at least give Ty Wallace, you know, a restricted free agency offer for a guaranteed minimum contract for a couple of years. So he's another guy that they could look to bring back. I mean, they had so many injuries last year, and they had such a revolving cast of characters. Is there any way that you would just waive Patrick Beverley? I think they would just try to trade him first before they did that.
Yeah, I think somebody would be willing to take him on, especially because Beverly's contract doesn't guarantee until January. So yeah.
Now, a team would have to have a trade exception or just to take him off the Clippers' hands. Because still, I mean, if you're going to bring back Bradley on the type of contract that you were talking about, Danny, you know, that would be what, like a one-year, probably eight-figure deal? Then you're looking at that. And if you bring back Teodosic as well, you want to use the full mid-level. Now you're basically done. You're out of space. They're gonna be limited on roster spots too here as well. Maybe they just end up waiving Wes Johnson as well, or trying to buy him out, or they could probably maybe move on from Sam Decker to open up a roster slot. Maybe there'd be a team that would just take Sam Decker. But I think that they have both a roster crunch and a little bit more of a cap crunch. And this is without even talking about DeAndre Jordan. If they do bring back Jordan, I mean, that's another concern here too. Like, they're actually gonna have to cut money probably under the tax, or if he opts in, they're gonna have to just cut money to get out of the tax. I mean, it seems really unlikely to me that they would pay the tax and be stuck in the repeater tax.
I would agree that it's unlikely. If DeAndre Jordan opts out and they choose not to bring him back, they could make a very quick pivot if they want to be proactive and do something with the Chris Paul trade exception. It's about $7 million. But the problem is it expires before the league year starts, so it would have to be a very specific type of contract, especially with the new rules of what guarantees count. I don't expect that to be there, but I wanted to mention it just because I get excited about unusual circumstances in the Chris Paul exception is there. So what would you say, let's make the assumption, and I think this is totally fair, that the absolute most the Clippers can work with is the mid-level exception, the full one, but, you know, maybe even the taxpayer one. What do you think is their biggest need?
Well, if DeAndre Jordan is not under contract, center. And that's even if they bring back Harrell, another guy who we're not even talking about fitting into this mix as well. So, like, they have a lot less flexibility, at least for this year. And that's another reason why it seems like it would be so foolhardy to take on money through next year as well. I mean, it seems like kind of a motley crew. So, I mean, I would say probably center. If they bring back Jordan, then I think this is just their team, unless they start making some trades. And maybe they just try to trade some of these guys in the backcourt to get a little more depth on the wing. But those are always tough to do as well. But, I mean, there are guys here who have trade value on this team. Yeah, what are you saying?
There are. And what I want to say is that it's also a risky proposition for them as a potential 2019 spender to stretch players. Because if they stretch guys, that money goes on the books in future seasons. And if they want to have $60 million to work with, you know, giving Austin Rivers or Wesley Johnson or Boban some money, like spreading that over 3 years wouldn't necessarily help them. No, they're not.
By the way, also we talked about this briefly, but it looks like Doc Rivers is going to extend there as well, just to be the coach, which I don't know whether that means that they're just not going to rebuild. I mean, I think they're just going to kind of hang around again in the same type of level. They also owe, at some point, a lottery-protected pick to the Celtics, right?
Well, I believe it's lottery-protected for 2 years and then becomes seconds. So there is a significant chance that that pick just ends up becoming seconds, which would be unfortunate for Boston. We looked at that and the Memphis pick as those two intriguing possibilities. And the Memphis pick could go in a lot of different directions. But something else I think is an important need for the Clippers if they want to be competitive next year, that's an if that we don't have an answer to yet, is somebody who can capably defend small forwards. Both Gallinari and Tobias Harris are talented offensive players and can be a part of a successful rotation, maybe even start those two guys. But having a third player who is defense first could be really useful to just play with either one of those players in a kind of three-man grouping.
Yeah, I mean, CJ Williams might be their best wing defenders. Thornwell has been pretty good, but he probably doesn't quite have the size. I could see also with both their roster crunch and their potential tax crunch, I don't know what like the value chart would be here, but if they wanted to combine 12 and 13 to try to move up, I think that might be something that, and especially with the team that just kind of needs to take flyers, like they don't need more role players on this team. So I would certainly be having talks if I were them to try and see where I could move up to. Now, I haven't looked at of course, who might be available in that range. I mean, I think maybe something interesting, this is just totally off the top of my head, and I don't know what kind of shape he's in at this point, but Michael Porter looked like a guy who had so much upside. You know, if he's in the 7 or 8 range, maybe, especially because you're always looking for wings, we don't know where he's going to be because of his back, but he's a guy who does, I think, to me, have superstar upside. So maybe you could try to combine those two picks to move up and grab him. You know, that might be the type of move that they could make because they do need to get more upside talent on this team. They have a lot of solid NBA players, but, you know, their best player is a 31-year-old who's probably going to win sixth man this year in Lou Williams.
I'm on board with the idea. It's always really hard to discuss value because a lot of it can be related to who is available, or maybe in certain cases teams can say refuse a deal. Like there was that reporting that came out recently with the Raptors trying to move up to get Giannis, but then Steven Adams was still on the board. And something else I wanted to mention with the Clippers, with their lack of flexibility, is because of their other spending obligations, it would be harder for them to wield DeAndre Jordan or Avery Bradley in a sign-and-trade, assuming they want to try to get below the tax. Now, if Jordan opts out and they want to do it with Bradley, that could work, but it's going to get complicated. And that's unfortunate because they're not good enough to be inflexible, but that's just where their books are.
Yeah, and back to your initial question, which I kind of poo-pooed, I don't think they can use the full mid-level exception. I mean, it would be, unless they just create some more flexibility somehow with some trades, I think it's unlikely they would use that. I think they won't necessarily be limited to the taxpayer because of going over the apron, because that's $6 million over the tax, but I think just because they won't be able to pay $8.4 million and necessarily avoid the tax unless they just don't bring back any of their pending free agents. And if Jordan opts in, I mean, they're going to just have to straight up cut money somehow. And I don't really see anyone who, you know, for $5 million a year, they've got a ton of guys in the backcourt already, so I don't think that's really a need. What about just center guys, you know, for kind of $3 million a year, $5 million a year, something like that? This might actually be a decent, like, Alex Len landing spot. You know, maybe he could be the starting center and, you know, a guy who has a little bit of upside. And then, you know, if they bring back Harrell, he can be the guy who plays center down the stretch in a lot of these games. Maybe it's a change of scenery for the 25-year-old Len.
The player taken right after Len, Nerlens right. Noel, would also be an option, more of a defensive first player. And when you're starting Danilo Gallinari, that seems like a pretty good idea. And Noel, I don't think a one-year kind of make-good contract is what he should be going for, considering what happened the last time he was on a one-year contract. But if he were to go that approach, the Clippers would be a wonderful option because they have playing time that they could say, hey, look at this. It's just you and Montrezl Harrell. You could figure this out.
No, but other than that, I don't really see it. Maybe like Trevor Booker as a small ball five could play there a little bit. I think, you know, Brook Lopez will probably be out of their price range. Maybe Greg Monroe is someone that they could look at as well, or like we'll see what the price line range is like for Ed Davis. But those are some of the guys I think we're talking about here.
I wouldn't want to start Channing Frye, but as a change of pace second unit guy, could be fun.
Yeah, well, remember the Clippers?
He's already in LA.
Had him years ago and decided not to get him, and they ended up dying because they had I think what was that? Was that 2016? That was 2016. Yeah, so it ended up not.
I believe it was
CP and Blake both got hurt in the playoffs anyway, so it wouldn't have mattered. But
and Jeff Green's going to be a free agent, so they can sign him again.
Well, now that we've started discussing that, it's time to wrap things up. Anything to plug before we depart here?
Yeah, my podcast for Real Jam Radio with Sirith Sohi is up now. I just put it out right before we recorded, and we went through the Raptors because we actually recorded that before Dwayne Casey got fired, but we talked about it kind of as if it was going to happen because we all thought it would at that point. And LeBron, his free agency, and a lot of other stuff. So that's out there. Off-season previews are rolling in. I'm going to be putting the finishing touches on a couple of them because it was waiting on what happened with a lot of results. And I'm pretty energized. I might end up doing the Suns one in the very near future as well, because this is now a very fascinating decision. I don't have an opinion on it yet, but that's not really what my off-season preview series is about usually. And we might wait to do the Suns until have a stronger opinion, but with the Athletic stuff, that's harder to do.
Yeah, and I think people are asking about the Pacers. We have not done their off-season preview yet. I wanted to see until we get some clarity on some of the player options that they have. I guess Joseph has already opted in, but there'll be some reporting on their non-guarantees as well. Thaddeus Young obviously is a huge one for them, but we'll get into some of these teams that have things a little bit more settled now over the next few days or so. And of course, Twitter NBA show for the series of the century, game two, pretty much do or die for the Houston Rockets. That'll be a fascinating one. Check that out with us at 6 Pacific tomorrow, 9 Eastern. Follow me on Periscope at Nate Duncan NBA, and or click the little bell next to my name on Twitter. You can get alerts to whenever we go live, and we only go live with Twitter NBA show, so that won't be too spammy for you at all. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow night. Till then.